Hey, welcome to Politico Tech. Today's Wednesday, June 5th. I'm Stephen Overly. Here are a few tech criticisms you've probably heard before. Social media divides us into echo chambers. Algorithms feed on conspiracy theories and controversy. And online advertising turns all that chaos into a moneymaker. But what does all of that mean for truth? That's a question on the mind of journalist and author Stephen Brill. And the title of his new book offers a blunt answer. It's called The Death of Truth. Stephen has spent decades in media. He founded The American Lawyer and Court TV. And for the past 6 years, he's been the co-CEO of NewsGuard, a site that tracks disinformation and rates the reliability of news sources. When I got Stephen's new book, I called him up to ask if truth is actually dead. He said, no, not really. As you'll hear on the show today, it's more like the truth is on life support, and Stephen has ideas for how to save it. Here's our conversation. Welcome to Politico Tech. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
You've written this new book. What was the central question or point that you really set out to illuminate here?
The point I set out to illuminate was it just struck me that we had gotten to a point in our world where there is, in fact, what I call the death of truth, which is nobody believes, or not enough people believe, in a shared set of facts. Who got the most votes is a matter of opinion.
Right.
Whether COVID is real is a matter of opinion. Whether the October 7th attack was a false flag operation by Israel is a matter of opinion. 30 years ago, my wife and I are in our daughter's third grade class. It's Parents' Day. And the teacher asks one of the students, how much is 6 times 7? And the student replies, it's 41. And the teacher says, I disagree. Well, all kind of rolled our eyes at that because 6 times 7 is a fact. It's not an opinion. And so I wanted to ask and answer the question, how did that happen? And now that it's happened, now that we live in a world of information, chaos, and polarization, what can we do to reverse course? And that's what the book attempts to do. So how did it happen? One of the things I discovered was, you know, was something we've all discovered over the last few years, which was that the social media algorithms have been geared to present inflammatory content as opposed to worrying about accurate content.
Right.
And so one of the factors have been the social media platforms and their algorithm. The other factor, less appreciated by your listeners, I bet, is programmatic advertising.
I want to ask you about programmatic advertising, actually, because that is something you touch on quite heavily in the book, and the idea that the business models and this programmatic advertising contribute to the problem. Can you map that out for me a bit?
Well, they finance the problem. You know, if you think back to, you know, the TV show Mad Men, people would decide over long martini lunches whether to advertise on Newsweek or Time or ABC or CBS. What's the
right
audience? Who's got the best demographics? There's nothing like that anymore. Now, with programmatic advertising invented at about the same time that the social media platforms were invented, it's all computerized, done by algorithm, and 80% of advertising is placed by advertisers who have no idea where the ads are going, what particular website it's going to be on. They're just trying to reach a specific demographic that the algorithm supposedly tells them they're going to reach at the lowest possible price. It's an auction. And 15 million ad impressions per second, I'll repeat that, 15 million per second are placed on websites and on, you know, some podcasts even, where there's no idea where the ads are going. It's just the computer has said, that's the demographic you want to reach.
Right. No quality control, you're saying.
Yes. So to give you another example, remember when Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, was attacked in his home?
Yep. Yep.
That night, a website called the Santa Monica Observer, which poses as a local news site in Santa Monica, and NewsGuard had identified it as a hoax site just in it for programmatic advertising. That website reported that Paul Pelosi had actually been in an encounter with a gay prostitute. Totally made up. Elon Musk retweeted that, Donald Trump Jr. retweeted that, and the result was that the Santa Monica Observer got a bonanza of programmatic advertising, because that's where all the eyeballs went, even if they just went there for a second to look at this stupid, crazy article. The San Francisco Chronicle, which actually pays, you know, reporters to report what really happened with Paul Pelosi, didn't get that advertising. The Santa Monica Observer got it. And advertising was from brands like Hertz, for example. The bluest blue chip brands you can imagine were advertising next to an article, you know, making up this story about Paul Pelosi. None of them wanted to be there. None of them knew they were there.
Well, I know you write that this problem is only getting worse with AI-generated content, because now publishing fake news and information to the internet, you can do cheaper and faster than ever. What accountability do you think is needed for how AI is used now that it's becoming more ubiquitous?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, everybody keeps talking about transparency.
Mm-hmm.
But what does that mean? What we know now is the generative AI companies have trained by basically crawling across the internet. What we don't know is, who do they pay attention to? It looks like they just pay attention to words without any weighting on whether the words are true or not. So they could pay as much attention to the Santa Monica Observer's words as they pay to the San Francisco Chronicle's words. So if that's the case, and if you prompted it to say, what happened to Paul Pelosi, who knows what the answer would be? So the first thing that has to happen is that transparency has to have real meaning, and the generative AI companies need to tell us, who are they training their data on? What are they training their data on? Now, that's exacerbated by the fact that a lot of the reputable publishers have said, you know what, we need to be paid for using our intellectual property. And until you pay us, we're not going to let you crawl our data. So the Santa Monica Observer is perfectly happy to let you crawl their data for AI, as I imagine is Sputnik and other Russian propaganda sites. They're,
right.
You know, NewsGuard's identified some 500 Russian propaganda sites, and that is a big perfect storm waiting to happen.
You know, I'm sure you've seen examples where Google search results that are AI generated have pulled in information from The Onion and from satirical sites or fake news sites, populated that information as though it were true. Is the solution to that, I mean, is it just transparency? Do you view the need for regulation or licensing or some other regime here?
Well, no, I thought I'd mention transparency first because it's important. The second thing I'll mention is something where your readers should be aware I have a completely self-serving interest in.
Okay.
And that is, NewsGuard rates the reliability of websites, and NewsGuard has the only catalog of all the false narratives that are out there every day on the internet. You can use that catalog of false narratives to create, in effect, you know, guardrails, which is you can train your system to say, no matter what, don't say Paul Pelosi was in an encounter with a gay prostitute, or no matter what, don't say that Colin Powell died from a COVID vaccine. Those are two examples of false narratives. You know, we have guardrails. We have, you know, thousands of them. You could also, with our website ratings, train your generative AI machine to pay more attention to Politico than to pay to the Santa Monica Observer. Because we vetted the Politico. We've given Politico a very high rating for reliability, as it should. And that's what needs to come into the equation, which is paying more attention to certain content than other content. Otherwise, they're just, you know, reading words.
Who enforces that? Because I could see more reputable company implementing some of those solutions maybe on their own, but certainly there will be folks who have more malicious intentions that won't abide by those guidelines voluntarily.
I think the financial incentives are the companies trying to be reputable, the companies raising billions of dollars. I think they have all the incentive in the world to go in the direction of producing content that people can count on. There will be others, whether it's a Russian propaganda outfit operating in St. Petersburg, or someone operating, you know, out of his basement in New Jersey. There'll be all kinds of other producers of generative AI that can become false multipliers when it comes to producing misinformation and disinformation. And there, I think you could have statutes in the US and globally saying that any internet service providers have to have some technology mechanism that watermarks something that is produced by AI versus produced by real people. And that's sort of the place in the pipeline where I think you could go after it. And you could do it constitutionally. It's content neutral. It's not saying you can't do this content, but you can do that content. It's just saying your customers deserve to know that what they're reading has been produced by a human being. So at least that'll deal with the force multiplier effect.
Right.
A couple of weeks ago at NewsGuard, one of our analysts went online and found a service provider operating out of Pakistan and asked the service provider, a generative AI provider, produce for me a fake news site covering politics in Ohio. And for $104, he had this perfectly beautiful website covering news of politics in Ohio. And then he said, steer all the content in a way that is favorable to the Democratic Senate candidate, Sherrod Brown. And suddenly the content produced stories about Sherrod Brown favoring, you know, always being in favor of Little League baseball, et cetera, et cetera. Just wonderful stuff about Sherrod Brown. The next day he said, you know, I've changed my mind. Produce content that favors Sherrod Brown's opponent. So the next day, Sherrod Brown's opponent was attacking Sherrod Brown for being against Little League baseball. And this guy was in favor of you know, Little League baseball and Girl Scouts and stuff like that. So, and that cost $104, and it was a continuous loop of content. And you could do that everywhere. So there have to be some kinds of watermarks, some kinds of controls on this stuff.
I want to ask you about a couple of other solutions that you suggest in the book, which seem to also be tied to transparency. One, which I thought was maybe even a bit of a controversial one, is sort of the end of online anonymity. What's your argument for that?
Well, my argument is that the benefits of being anonymous online are real. There's no getting around it, but they're now outweighed by the danger of it. So the benefits are that if you want to go online today, set up your own personal account and, you know, criticize something that Politico's done, you won't get in trouble, or you won't embarrass your family, or in a repressive state, you won't have, you know, the government coming down on you. So that's a real benefit. I mean, that kind of anonymity is important. It's now outweighed by the reality that, you know, 1,000 Russian bots can be online. Or if you're a serious doctor and want to speak in favor of the COVID vaccine, someone who is selling hydroxychloroquine can go on and talk about how your vaccine is going to kill people and my hydroxychloroquine is going to be what saves their lives. That kind of accountability, which is the opposite of being anonymous online, I think has become far preferable to being completely unaccountable online.
There's also the suggestion, which I think is related, that fake news sites or what's called pink slime sites should have to disclose kind of who's backing them, who their funders are. What is the case for those sort of disclosures? What change would that have?
Well, the whole idea is if you're reading something online, especially something that is posing as journalism, you ought to know who's financing it and who's behind it, especially if the people paying for it are not paying for it for journalistic reasons. So one of the problems I identify in The Death of Truth is that real, decent local journalism, which may have its faults, you know, they make mistakes and all the rest of it, has been undermined by pink slime sites, as we call them, on the left and on the right, more so on the left a little bit than on the right. So the Democratic candidate's going to get stories that he, you know, went to a ribbon cutting at a homeless shelter, and the Republican opponent's going to get stories about some scandal, real or unreal, that happened to him in college or high school. That's not journalism, and I'm one of those people, and the whole point of my book is that the death of truth has come because we no longer depend on what I call the referees in our society. The referees are doctors, they're judges, they're journalists, they're people working at the polls on election day. They're experts who say that, you know, the climate really is getting warmer. Well, one of those referees are journalists who we think are calling the shots as they see them. We count on them to do that, especially with local news. We don't count on them being, you know, financed and given a mission to support one political candidate over the other.
On that last point about the referees, there is an argument that those referees that we've had traditionally are themselves flawed. You know, they have a bias. Some voices have been left out.
That's absolutely true.
And so is the idea to restore truth to kind of get back to what we had, or is it to get something better?
Well, I think it's to get something better, because you could argue that, you know, in the 70s, wasn't it great? We didn't have all this, you know, social media platforms, online disinformation, and we had three broadcast networks that basically told us what the news was. And we had three or four big magazine and newspaper companies. So the mainstream media was really the media. And, well, that was okay, except look at all the stories they missed or came late to, because there wasn't a diversity of voices or viewpoints. So that's not perfect. But what you want to get back to is something that is something other than anybody and everybody, no matter how they're financed or what their credentials are or what their agenda is, being able to, in effect, to broadcast to, you know, a billion people at a time, whether it's video or text. So yes, the referees are flawed, but the fact is, if a poll worker actually is corrupt, you used to be able to count most of the time on other poll workers or the press or someone pointing out that flaw in the system. If a judge was biased, there'd be criticism from lawyers, from other judges, from the press. But by and large, most of the time, not all the time, most of the time, we were able to count on referees.
Let me ask you one last question here. The book is called The Death of Truth. Is truth actually dead?
No. Truth is actually on defense. What I mean by that is that too many things that are true, whether it's 6 times 7 actually being 42, or whether the COVID vaccine actually saving more people than it kills, those are facts, and they're not debatable. And we have come apart as a society, as a country, as a global democracy, because too many of us have been lured into not believing in what should otherwise be truths that are accepted pretty much the way we accept that 6 times 7 is 42.
Well, listen, the book is called The Death of Truth. It is out now. Stephen Brill, thanks for being here on Politico Tech.
Thank you for having me.
That's all for today's Politico Tech. For more tech news, subscribe to our newsletters, Digital Future Daily and Morning Tech. Music in today's episode comes from the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our managing producer is Annie Reese. Our producer is Afra Abdullah. And our editors are Steve Heuser, Daniela Cheslow, and Louisa Savage. I'm Stephen Overley. See you back here tomorrow.